The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's show...
If you were to stack those viruses end to end, it would actually extend out 60 million light years.
I'll be talking to the one, the only Carl Zimmer. He's discussing the surprising variety and power of viruses. And...
My students in Oxford told me I sound exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
So I had this message on my answer phone. I'm away at the moment, but I'll be back.
No, it's not the Terminator, but a super cooperator. The evolutionary biologist Martin Novak explains why he thinks human cooperation is such a crucial pillar of Darwinian evolution. And in the news this week, a gene for happiness and how your morning coffee could be more risky than you think. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome back. My guest this week is probably the only Science Weekly interviewee who can claim to have had a tapeworm named after him. It's the celebrated science writer Carl Zimmer. Carl is widely published in the US and around the world, and he's penned many books on evolution and biology. He also writes the award-winning blog The Loom, part of the Discover magazine's blogs network. Carl's latest book is Planet of Viruses, where he attempts to lift the lid on one of the most successful life forms on Earth. Hi, Carl. Welcome to Science Weekly. Now, when we talk about viruses normally, we're told that we have to get rid of them, kill them, do whatever we can. They're bad things. Your book reads like it's written by someone who thinks that viruses might have had a bit of a bad rap.
Well, some of them are quite dangerous, and yet some of them are pretty harmless. But all of them are incredibly powerful and incredibly abundant. I mean, the fact is that most of the living organisms on Earth are viruses. There are far, far more viruses than all the bacteria and animals and plants and other species combined. So it really is this viral world. So whether you like them or not, they're something that just can't be ignored.
Now, just spool back a sec and tell us, what is defined scientifically as a virus, and when did we know that they existed?
We certainly knew about viruses for thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, whenever anybody got sick with some viral disease, they were feeling the effects, but they didn't realize exactly what was happening to them and what was responsible. It wasn't until the late 1800s that scientists even recognized that there was some particular agent that was causing these viral diseases. I mean, basically all they would do is they would take tissue from things that were sick. They actually started with tobacco plants, and they mashed up these sick tobacco plants and mixed them with water and then passed them through very fine filters. They actually passed them through porcelain. And so bacteria could not get through the pores. And yet when they took this fluid and then injected it into other plants, the plants got sick too. And so they started talking about what they called a contagious living fluid. And it wasn't actually until the 1930s that they invented microscopes that were powerful enough to finally see that there were these minuscule particles floating around that we know of today as viruses.
And you said earlier that there's more viruses in the world than pretty much any other life form. Can you give us a sense of scale? I mean, how many or how many kilograms compared to the rest of life?
The latest number I've seen is 10 to the 31st power viruses.
Number of viruses.
Yeah, the number of viruses. So you write a 10 and then, you know, you put 31 zeros after there. You know, if you were to stack those viruses end to end, if you had a lot of free time on your hands, it would actually extend out 60 million light years.
I love facts like that. That can't be true. I don't know how that's true, but I'm sure someone's worked it out well.
You know, you have to bear in mind that, I mean, in every spoonful of soil or seawater, there are hundreds of thousands or millions of viruses. I mean, they're just everywhere. Everywhere that life can exist, there are viruses.
Everyone probably knows about viruses that cause illness, you know, the common cold or flu, HIV, all these sorts of things. Let's talk instead about viruses which are kind of unexpected. In the book, you talk about beneficial viruses and how that sometimes you could think about viruses as being crucial for the evolution of life. I mean, how have they interacted with us, and how, why are they crucial for the evolution of life on Earth? You'd think, you'd normally think that they would destroy things, right?
Right. Well, you would think that, but there's a lot of variety in the way that viruses make a living. So, you know, some of them, like the flu, they make a living the way that we learned about in textbooks, where they invade cells, blow them open, and thousands of new viruses come out. But actually, there are a whole lot of viruses. What they do is they go from cell to cell, and they actually insert their genes into their host genome, and then they just stay there, and they sort of merge into their host. They still have the capacity later to make new viruses and break out, but as long as times are good, they just become part of the host. One of the strangest examples that I write about in the book is that, you know, in the ocean, there's a lot of photosynthesis going on. There are a lot of bacteria that are using energy from the sun to take in carbon dioxide and to combine it with water and to produce organic carbon, and they actually give off oxygen. So a huge amount of the oxygen we breathe comes from these bacteria. Turns out that there are viruses that carry with them genes for photosynthesis, for harnessing sunlight. They carry them around with them, and they invade bacteria, plug in these photosynthesis genes. The photosynthesis genes switch on, and the bacteria start harnessing sunlight. So this is viral photosynthesis going on.
And the bacterium couldn't do it without the virus.
Right. So we're actually breathing virus oxygen.
And in the human genome, are there viruses there too?
There are thousands of viruses in there. Every now and then, over the course of evolution, in animals, viruses manage to infect the cells that go on to become eggs and sperm. And once that happens, the virus's DNA is passed down along with the host's own genes. And a lot of the time, what happens is that mutations cripple the virus so it can't escape any longer. And it's just part of our genome. There are some estimates, I think they're up to about 8% or 9% of the human genome is these viral elements. But you have to bear in mind, there are only like about 1.2% of the human genome is protein coding genes. So we're much more virus than we are, you know, the genes that we think of as being us that make our proteins in our bodies.
And what are these virus genes doing? Well, what are these virus genomes, what are they doing inside us? I mean, do they have any function?
Most of them are just effectively dead. You know, they're just along for the ride. However, you know, sometimes they evolve. There's some raw material there for evolution to act on. And so there are cases in which some of that DNA has been moved around, it's been mutated just through ordinary evolution and has taken on new functions. So, for example, in mammals like us, the fetus makes placenta, the placenta sticks to the uterus. It sticks to the uterus with these proteins that sort of clamp on. Those are actually... the genes for those came from viruses. So without viruses, placental mammals, including us, just wouldn't be here.
We've talked about synthetic biology on the podcast before, and it's always many decades away because we're just at the beginning of actually understanding how complex this stuff is. You say that viruses are simpler. Does that mean that we might have virus-based therapies or technologies slightly earlier, or are they sort of more likely to happen?
You know, the irony is that I think at this point, the real stumbling block for using viruses that have been engineered through synthetic biology is regulation. At least here in the United States, the FDA is not really comfortable regulating viruses used for medical applications. This has actually been a long-standing problem. So I was actually talking to an MIT scientist named Tim Liu, who is taking an interesting kind of detour as a result. So what he's done is he's engineered phages so that they're really good at invading biofilms made by bacteria. Biofilms are a big problem in human health, because you know, infections sometimes are formed by bacteria that create these kind of rubbery sheets, and then they're very hard to get antibiotics into, and they can line catheters and whatnot. It's a big problem. And he's engineered these viruses that basically like just blast these biofilms apart, and he's shown in his lab again and again. Rather than trying to take on that regulatory challenge for using it medically, the first thing he's doing is he's going to cure buildings. And you know, it turns out that heating and air conditioning ducts in buildings are a great place for bacteria to form biofilms. And the thicker these biofilms get, the more inefficient these buildings become, because the heat can't radiate. It becomes a problem. The heat transfer becomes a problem because these biofilms are in the way. And so his plan is, with the company, is to unleash these viruses on buildings and cure them of these biofilms and save the owners of these buildings a lot of money, because the efficiency of these systems can go way up if you use viruses on them.
You know, you've just described the preamble to a science fiction apocalypse movie. Big thanks to Carl Zimmer there. Planet of Viruses is available now from the Chicago University Press. And for more information on Carl's other writings, check out his website at carlzimmer.com. News Jack. In the studio now to discuss some of this week's science news is Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. First up, Ian, tell us why these three things are related.
So these three things, and we're talking about drinking coffee, hard exercise, and blowing your nose, is that they all topped a list that was published last week on the triggers that can lead to someone having a burst blood vessel in the brain, essentially, which can cause a particular kind of stroke.
So in the study, did they identify how wide this risk is?
Well, we already know that there are something like between 1% and 6% of people in the UK have what's called a brain aneurysm. Now, this is a blood vessel in the brain, usually at the bottom of the brain, that has a little bulge in the side. You get a weakness in the blood vessel wall, and that lets it bulge out. Now, having that aneurysm in itself is reasonably common. It's not doesn't often cause any symptoms, and it's actually pretty benign. The problem comes when those aneurysms burst, because then you can get a bleed on the brain, causes a stroke, and that can cause you brain damage, which is often fatal. The question that these doctors were looking to answer was, why does one aneurysm burst when another one doesn't? There's a lot of uncertainty over what actually causes one of these things to burst, which can be seriously dangerous for one person, whereas in another person it won't do anything.
So what were some of the other triggers? And what is it about these things that can cause the aneurysm to possibly burst?
So what these guys did, they gave patients who had survived having one of these bleeds in the brain a questionnaire which asked them about tens of different potential triggers, and what they all had in common were they could cause an abrupt rise in your blood pressure. And you can imagine how that might, if you have a weakened aneurysm, a weak part of a blood vessel, you can imagine how a sudden rush of blood pressure could cause that to burst. And what they did was they compared what the person was doing in the immediate run-up to having that that burst aneurysm to the frequency of them doing that in their everyday life. So were you having sex immediately before you had a stroke? Were you exercising vigorously? Were you straining on the toilet before you had your stroke? And these actually all came out as triggers, potential triggers for these aneurysms bursting. Now, the thing most strongly linked with one of these aneurysms rupturing was drinking coffee within the hour beforehand. That accounted for an estimated 10.6% of these burst aneurysms that you get in the population. Vigorous exercise came next, then it was nose blowing. And after those, we had sex, straining on the toilet, drinking cola, being startled, and finally being angry could also raise your blood pressure.
You're more likely to get your blood pressure raised by being startled than being angry. No, you can't really generalise this to the entire population, I'm sure. But on a more serious note, though, the strokes themselves, I mean, how serious can they be, and what can you do about them?
These can be fatal, spectacularly serious. About 10% of people who have a brain aneurysm burst die before they get to hospital. You will get a significant number who will die, about a third die within a month of having that kind of stroke. There will be about 10 to 15% of people who recover perfectly well or reasonably well enough to get back to an active life, whether that's going back to work or whatever they are doing if they're not working. And then the people in between will have various levels of brain damage usually, and many of them end up in long-term care.
Okay, Ian, a story late last week. The scientists who discovered a happiness gene always makes you sort of slightly cautious, but tell us how true this is.
Well, this is actually more of a multi-purpose researcher at LSE, London School of Economics, than what we sort of might typically think of as a group of scientists doing the research. But what this guy did, his name is Jean-Emmanuel Deneuve. He looked at more than 2,500 Americans, medical records of these Americans, who had had certain genes sequenced, and checked a particular gene variant against their answer to a questionnaire that they were given when they're in their mid-20s. And that question was simply, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? And you could answer from very dissatisfied to very satisfied. It's like a scale of 1 to 5. And what he's done is basically said that there are two variants of a particular gene that are, if you have two long versions of these genes, essentially, you are more likely to say you're very satisfied with your life than if you have two short versions.
There's various things you can go into in this. I mean, there can't just be one gene for happiness, can there?
Absolutely not. I mean, they don't know how much of the genetic component of happiness this particular gene variant accounts for. And you can't talk about causality. All you can talk about really is a correlation. But there is a mechanism for why this holds, and they have replicated it in a separate group of people, in the very famous Framingham group of people in the US. Now, the way it's supposed to work is that if you have a longer version of this gene variant, it actually improves the transport of serotonin, which is this feel-good neurotransmitter in the brain. If you have a shorter version, it tends to transport less well. Now, that is the sort of postulated mechanism that's going on here, but it's so far just a suggestion.
Isn't there another problem with the fact that if you are given a questionnaire to say how happy are you, there are many variables around how happy you might be at that time, the differences in between different people's self-reports of this stuff. I assume they've taken that into account, but I mean, it sounds very crude at that end, but very technological at the other end, end.
It's interesting. If you look at this questionnaire, it's a very standard question and a very standard metric, 1 to 5, the way you measure it. If you do that pretty much in any population, the vast majority of people who answer that question will say one below the top rank. So they will say satisfied. Okay, so you have most people saying, yeah, satisfied. You have a tiny amount saying very dissatisfied, a small amount saying, you know, neither this, neither that. Basically, if you add up the bottom three groups, it comes to about a fifth of all of the population. Everybody else weights themselves either as satisfied or very satisfied.
Well, unless you've just surveyed them after some amazing win from their football team or something.
Exactly. And even though they're supposed to look at life as a whole, it's actually pretty hard to do that. So there is an inherent issue there. It's absolutely.
And just one final thing. I mean, happiness, whatever you want to call it, from a genetic point, sort of biological point of view, sort of feeling good, well-being, etc. There must be a genetic component. How much of the sort of happiness is genetic compared to the environmental situation you're in?
Well, so the classic way of doing this is you look at twins who have been essentially separated at birth and brought up in different environments, and then go and ask them how happy they are. Now, what you tend to find is that the happiness will be correlated, it will be similar, but from that you can work out that genetics is probably having an influence on about a third to a half of the variation in happiness that you see across people. So it's actually a small amount, and a lot of that is going to be, a lot of the other component is going to be environment and the way the environment interacts with those genes.
Thanks, Ian. For all of Ian Sample's glorious words on science, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Yes, that's what I call cooperation. Each person is doing one part of the job. Mr. Hooper is passing out the plates. Bob is serving the cake, and Brian's passing out the glasses. Susan is pouring the juice. Look how fast the job gets done when everyone cooperates.
Martin Novak may or may not have been influenced by Sesame Street's tireless advocacy of cooperation, but his work as an evolutionary biologist has led him to focus on this particular aspect of human and animal behaviour. It's also at the heart of his new book called Super Cooperators, The Mathematics of Evolution, Altruism and Human Behaviour, or Why We Need Each Other to Succeed. The book is co-authored with New Scientist editor Roger Highfield and sets out to extend Darwin's thoughts on natural selection by asserting that cooperation is one of the master architects of evolution. Our own super cooperator, Nell Bowes, met up with Martin Novak and began by asking him to explain the premise of the book.
What we are proposing in this book is that there is a third pillar of evolution, and this is cooperation. And the reason is, without cooperation, you don't really get construction. You don't get construction of complex structures, such as a cell, the first cell, such as multicellular organisms, such as insect societies or human society.
So I think most people listening to this podcast would understand the mechanism of mutation and the mechanism of selection. How do you get cooperation?
So cooperation is then the idea that there is one individual, and one individual does a certain action to reduce its fitness, and thereby it increases the fitness of another individual. Another interesting thing is, why would you do this? Why would you pay a cost such that a competitor has a benefit? Mm-hmm. And this is really the conundrum of cooperation, or the dilemma of cooperation.
This is why people over the years have asked, where does altruism come from? What possible benefit could it be?
Yes, what benefit could it be? And in game theoretic terms, we describe this with the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma is a game in the context of game theory, which is a field of mathematics that was invented by John von Neumann and Oskar Morgenstern in order to study strategic and economic decisions of humans. The prisoner's dilemma is one of many games in this theory, and it's the game that describes the problem of cooperation in its purest form.
Can you give us a quick recap of the prisoner's dilemma?
So the prisoner's dilemma, there are two individuals, mm-hmm. and each one has a choice between two options, between two moves, and one is cooperate and one is defect. And now if we both cooperate, we get a higher payoff than if we would both defect.
So, for example, if we cooperate and don't dob each other in, then we get a smaller prison sentence than if we defect and tell the police that the other guy did it.
Yes, that's right. So it is told, the name prisoner's dilemma comes from this version of the game where there are two people that committed a joint crime, and then the police offers both of them a deal. And they say, if you confess, then we will make you witness of the prosecution and you have a reduced prison sentence, but it's your partner that will go into prison for a longer time.
And so you took this sort of basic concept and developed into game theory, into kind of iterated situations where you can model how behaviours evolve and how organisms or whoever the actors are in this setup have different strategies, and how you get a different kind of evolution of those strategies within that population. So you get kind of people who cooperate on the tit-for-tat basis, or people who are more generous than that. How do you get things like generosity or forgiveness, models of those things out of
the first observation would then be, if we just look at the prisoner's dilemma in this isolated form, where we just have the choice between cooperation and defection, there isn't really an incentive to cooperate. So we will both end up with defection. And because it's the Nash equilibrium, it's the strategy that is kind of the winning strategy for this game, but we would have both been better off had we cooperated. So this cooperative outcome is not really possible in this normal, single, isolated prisoner's dilemma. The same is true for natural selection. So natural selection cannot favor cooperation unless you provide a mechanism for the evolution of cooperation. And in the book, we describe five mechanisms. And the first mechanism, which we describe, which is particularly relevant for humans, the second mechanism. So the first one is direct reciprocity. And direct reciprocity is that there are repeated encounters between the same two individuals. And if there are these repeated encounters, it's now possible to actually get to cooperation.
So then you have that kind of idea of repetition. And then the other for the idea of reputation. So the idea
the second mechanism is then indirect reciprocity, and here the idea is that we don't have these repeated interactions between the same two people, but we might have repeated interactions in a group. So I cooperate with you, and then maybe somebody observes this and thinks that I'm a valuable member of the community and will then cooperate with me. This is indirect reciprocity based on reputation.
And then you talk about other types of selection, spatial selection and group selection and kin selection. I mean, the part about kin selection is quite controversial, isn't it? I know it builds on a paper that you wrote with Wilson last year in Nature, so it's this kind of, it's this idea, Haldane's idea of, I wouldn't jump into a river to rescue a stranger, but maybe I should jump into a river to rescue two brothers or eight cousins.
So the kin selection mechanism is not that controversial, and I also don't really have problems with the kin selection mechanism if properly formulated. So that's what I'm trying to do in the book.
So what do you think is wrong with the current, with previous formulations?
It's the underlying mathematics that describes kin selection, which is called inclusive fitness theory. And so in one chapter of the book, but also in this Nature paper published last year, we outline that inclusive fitness theory is an unnecessary approach to actually study kin selection. So the big discovery of the Nature paper last year was, and this was a surprise for me, and I think for many people who think about it very carefully, is that once fitness is calculated, every aspect of relatedness is included. So all you have to do is to calculate normal natural selection and fitness, and the whole effect of population structure and relatedness is already in there.
So you don't have to have this idea of inclusive fitness that is somehow bigger than the,
yeah,
encompasses
fitness,
more than the organism you're looking at.
Inclusive fitness is something that arises if you choose a level of description on the individual. But the more relevant level of description would be on the gene, typically, you know, it depends on the situation. So if I could illustrate it with Haldane, you know, Haldane says he would jump into the river to save two brothers. Then on one hand, you could say, so how does this work for the inclusive fitness of Haldane? Does sort of this reaction benefit the inclusive fitness of Haldane? But inclusive fitness is a very fragile concept. So sometimes you can do such a calculation, but not in general, not typically.
Okay. So what you're saying is that you should be, it's sort of a misnomer to be looking at the fitness of Haldane. You should be looking at the fitness of the gene within
exactly
Haldane.
Yes, right, exactly right. So the precise scientific question would be the following. Imagine there's a gene in the population that makes someone like Haldane look out in the river and see if there's the brother in there, recognize the brother, and then jump in. And now the question is, under which conditions is that gene favored by natural selection? And to do that precise calculation, I do not need inclusive fitness theory.
So all of this comes down to also to the level at which you look at fitness and the level at which you look at population, as you say. I know that you subtitle your group selection chapter Tribal Wars, which is, I assume, partly a reference to actual wars between tribes, between groups, but also to the kind of bandying about of terms like heresy in discussions of group selection over the past 20 years. I know David Sloan Wilson called for truth and reconciliation a couple of years ago about group selection discussions. What's been the problem with that?
When group selection was introduced in the 60s, it was introduced in a loose verbal way, and people found issue with this. So examples were given for group selection, which were not good examples.
What, because you couldn't, I mean, there were sort of arguments that you couldn't have selection at a group level because you didn't have groups dying out and reproducing in the way that you might
think? Not really, that's not the decisive way to look at it. This is my perspective. Once you move to an exact mathematical description of the problem, you can see very clearly when group selection works and when it doesn't work. So it does work in certain cases, it doesn't work in other cases, it's just a straightforward mathematical calculation. And I think group selection is very important when we think of the evolution of the first cell, and when we think especially about the evolution of human society, where there can be a competition between different tribes, as Darwin himself put it, and we quote this in our book. Or in modern life, you know, there can be competition between different companies, say Virgin Atlantic and British Airways. Typical examples of group selection. So then one company could win over the other company if the people inside that company are more helpful with each other. So there's nothing wrong with group selection a priori, and only recently I think we have a very good mathematical understanding of how group selection works.
So I think, and this is a theme that runs through the book, of the way, how important it is to abstract a problem from a biological setup and be able to describe it precisely mm-hmm. mathematically. Yes. Is that... Do you think that's the only approach, or do you think that's the best approach?
I think this is now the most rigorous approach, or the most precise approach. Our understanding of evolution has advanced tremendously over the last decades, and now ideas of evolution really should be, and I sort of want to push sort of in this direction, must be formulated in terms of mathematical equations. In the same way as sort of with the discovery of Newtonian mechanics, you would not just have a discussion about the solar system, talking about it, you would want to see the equations. And I think we have reached the same stage in evolution.
You don't want to sort of sit there describing epicycles and things like that. You want to actually...
Yes, I think many of the big debates or apparent controversies out there, they actually don't exist. They are immaterial if you look at the mathematical equations.
Can I ask you a bit more about the structure of the book? I mean, I very much liked the fact that it feels like part autobiography. You really managed to weave in kind of the story of what it's like meeting these other great minds and meeting your wife, and I the idea of sitting in an alpine hut having chats about game theory just sounds so lovely. But it's quite unusual to get that amount of sort of personal information in this kind of book, I think. Why did you decide on that approach?
I think we wanted in this book not only to present the science, but we also want to describe the circumstances and the background and the interactions that lead to then particular scientific insights. So I wanted to write a book that somehow presents the enthusiasm that one can actually feel, that one can feel as a scientist. This is the enthusiasm that I want to communicate not only to my students in Harvard, but also to the readers of the book. So to be a scientist is a fascinated life, and you feel like an artist. And as an artist, you want to express your creativity. And you love what you are doing, you know, you want to do it at any cost. You know, even if you are on vacation, on holiday, sort of a true holiday is just to be able to do your work.
And do you think that that's a message that doesn't get across enough?
No, I don't think very few people can actually understand the everyday life of a scientist. So it's even more than this. So the dream life of a scientist is the following. You wake up early in the morning, you look at your calendar and you realize it's empty. There's nothing there. That's what you want. So you have time to think. You have time to think until you have done something. And then in the evening, you ask yourself the question, what have you discovered today?
It's glorious. It reminds me rather a lot of Richard Feynman and the way that he wrote and sort of included that joy of discovery and the joy of mental endeavor. Is that what you were sort of aiming for?
Or? Yeah, that's what I'm very much aiming for.
And how was it working with Roger Highfield?
It was a fantastic experience. So he kind of approached me, let's write a book together. We met long, long ago in Oxford already. And he had covered several of my papers for various newspapers or journals like the Daily Telegraph. And then he said, let's write a book together. And he said, but let's think about it carefully because it's a little bit like getting married, you know, and I don't want you to be upset with me and have a Roger Highfield voodoo doll in your office.
Yes, no, always good to avoid the voodoo dolls of prominent editors. And finally, I just wanted to ask you a bit. You have a sort of, well, I don't know, a grand vision for a future, but you sort of open the gates to a conversation about how we as a race could cooperate mm-hmm. in the future. And I wondered how, I was sort of interested in the difference between the skills that we evolve and the reasons why we've evolved particular skills and how different that is from our conscious decision then to use them in particular ways.
Yeah, I think the final message in the book is then to realize that we are facing tremendous problems at the moment, kind of global problems, for example, the CO2 emission, the climate game, population growth, And in some sense, these problems cannot really be addressed with technical solutions. I think they require a behavioral or a game theoretic approach. And the game theoretic approach that is needed is that people have to learn to cooperate, not only with the immediate neighbors or with the people in the office, but on a global scale. So we have to be willing to reduce aspects of our luxurious life such that somebody else, maybe somewhere on the globe, has a benefit. And then the game gets even more complicated, because not only are we called to cooperate with others who are alive now, but actually with the future generations.
But how do you do that? Because in game theory, there's rarely a strategy that says, right, explain to each member of the game why cooperation would be useful. So do we not need a strategy that works on give a benefit to person A so they can understand why cooperation would work? Or
yeah, people should understand the game. I think you get people to cooperate if it's clear to them that their reputation is at stake. So like companies, for example, if there's like, you can use the web, you know, on the web information can spread very, very quickly. Companies could then get the image to be environmentally concerned about what they're doing, more so than others, and maybe then customers prefer to go for that company.
So you use mechanisms of cooperation such as reputation in order to kind of try and drive that.
Yes, very much. And I think the World Wide Web can help very much to proliferate reputation of people, of companies, of governments to an enormous extent.
Would you ever get involved in politics?
No, I don't think so. My relation with politics is the following, that my students in Oxford told me I sound exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
So I had this message on my answer phone: I'm away at the moment, but I'll be back.
A huge thanks to Martin Novak there. Super Cooperators is out now and published by Canongate. That's all we have for you this week on Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. And make sure you come back next week too.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.